problem that there were more than you expected, and it would be very difficult to index on a computer, correct? So that's why you're here?
Correct.
You have to have some method other than names to...
If you would like those numbers, I do have those, including the 18 Ole Olsons in the state.
And there was what, 12 Glenn Seversons?
There were only 4 Glenn Seversons, 82 Tom Smiths, 150 John Johnsons, 9 Eli Hofers, but only 1 Lena Olson.
Okay, any questions for Presiding Judge Severson? If not, thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
Any further proponents of this proposal?
Neil Fulton, Chief Justice, members of the court. So far as I know, there's only one of me, and my fiance thinks that's one too many. If I could just briefly address Justice Meyer Henry's question. I'm here for the professional responsibility rules, but you asked a question that I have some experience with. It's really hard, in our experience, to get the adverse party's information. Looking at the rule, I think this would be very workable if it were changed to say that for the filing party, it's provided. And instead of saying for the adverse party, they may seek a waiver, that it say, and for the adverse party, if available. Our experience has been before that we sent in pleadings that were fairly time sensitive. We got it late from an insurance company, didn't have the adverse party information. We're trying to meet a deadline, and it wouldn't get filed by the clerk until the judge sent the waiver. So I think if you did that and just said it's for the filing party or the adverse party, if available, most lawyers could make this work. At least that's our experience. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a minute. Any questions for Mr. Polk? No, thank you. Any further proponents to this proposal? If not, any opponents to this proposal? If not, we'll proceed then to... Judge Severson, would you return to the podium? There's a question from the bench.
Judge Severson, what about Mr. Fulton's suggestion? Does that, if you had a chance to look at that or think about it?
I believe it's already in there. It was our intent to add it. If you read the first line, it states that the person filing will contain identifying information available to that party. And then going on, it states that the identifying information for the filing party must be submitted with the filing statement. If the party representing is unable to provide the required information for the filing party, he shall seek the waiver. So if you can't provide the information for your own client, then you have to seek a waiver.
Oh, okay. Does that answer your question, Justice?
Yes, thank
you. Okay, any further questions for Judge Severson?
So what was the that is the intent of the rule, that it be required for the filing party, and then when an answer is filed, that the party filing the answer then provide for their client. However, in those instances where a person first files a complaint, if they do have the identifying information for the other party that they submitted.
One question. If that's on the complaint and on the summons and on the answer that the adverse party puts in, is it going to be expunged then?
We're not asking. In fact, we would discourage that it be on the pleadings. We are saying that that information be provided on the separate civil filing statement. That civil filing statement, then once the information is entered into the computer, it can either be destroyed by the clerk, and this rule specifically authorizes its destruction, or it be kept in a separate file, which is a non-public file.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions for Judge Severson? If not, thank you for returning, Judge. Any further comments, either opponents or proponents, of proposal number 9? There being none, we'll proceed to proposal number 10, proposed rules revisions to the South Dakota Rules of Professional Responsibility. Mr. Barnett, we have received not only the rules, I believe you filed a proposed amendment, and we are also aware of that. My understanding is that that is based on action taken by the American Bar Association, correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chief Justice.
Okay.
Good morning. I'd like to give a brief overview of the history of where we got to this morning. In 1999, in light of the ABA national move on studying Ethics 2000 and to do the first major revision in some 15 years, our bar, with a representative of the judicial system, both Justice Konenkamp and several circuit judges, went to work and to review our rules, and also to review the work product of the Ethics 2000 ABA level. By and large, we were our committee agreed with the recommendations of Chief Justice VC, I believe is his name, and that esteemed Blue Ribbon panel, with some marked deviations, such as those instances where our bar and our court over the years have adopted certain policies, such as under 1.4, the obligation of our members to advise their clients if they are not maintaining malpractice insurance. And the ABA decided to not address that issue. We've addressed that issue and made the policy, and we thought we ought to keep that. I don't know if the court kept your program from the annual meeting, but the intro to the Ethics 2000 discusses the changes in the basic things. Frankly, there's very little change of substance other than the major change would be that instead of requiring on those issues where a client needs to be involved, the current rules talk about consultation with a client. We are now saying informed consent. That is a major change. We think it's a beneficial change because it ensures that the lawyer will comply and actually consult with the client, and will serve to protect the lawyer when a subsequent complaint is made. Further, it requires that if you are in a conflict situation, and of course we all know that there are certain conflicts that are waivable once you consult with your client, it requires that it be done in writing, that the client sign. And we view that as a very positive thing because we get the complaints. And if you pull out your book, the page before Ethics 2000 is a list of the disciplinary board complaints in the past calendar year. And representing conflicting interests were 17 complaints. And many of those would have disappeared had the lawyer obtained the signed consent from the client. It's, as we so often understand, it's only when things go the wrong way that now the client is dissatisfied with the decisions that he or she may have participated in earlier. The informed consent and the right of consultation, again, that would be number 5, which I call lack of communication. 11 complaints of those. Sometimes, and I don't know if there are any golfers on the court, but sometimes golfers complain about the rules of golf, and I've always told them those rules are there to help the golfer, not to penalize. And I take the same approach with the rules of professional conduct. Those rules are there to help lawyers avoid problems. And we think that those substantive changes of signed waivers in the conflict situation and requiring informed consent are very positive. I will note that there were several floor amendments that were made, so this blue book is not accurate on several of those rules. The ones that we have filed with the court do reflect those changes.
With the exception of that late amendment.
That's correct.
All right.
That's correct. We were contacted either immediately prior to or during the course of the annual meeting with concerns both from the U.S. Attorney's Office and Attorney General's Office, and also by the defense lawyers and DRI. Their amendments were very acceptable. We proposed those on the floor. Each amendment passed unanimously. So we think we've addressed those issues. Frankly, we had anticipated greater controversy on the reciprocal licensing and multi-jurisdictional practice. Those were explained, and there was an area of dissenting vote. Subsequent to that, I do want to return just for a second back to the late submission from us asking that the overstrikes on 163B be removed. And the reason for that was that when the committee did its work, unless we had a very solid identifiable reason to deviate from the Bible, which is the annotated model rules, then we decide we'd comply. And so we proposed to delete that language, or to the extent that revelation appears to be necessary to rectify the consequences of a client's criminal or fraudulent act in which the lawyer's services had been used, with the idea that we would then be able to rely on all the annotations because the rule would be the same. During the course of the discussion at the annual meeting, Dean Vickery inquired about the reason, we explained the reason, and we moved on. Subsequent to our annual meeting, the ABA sent out word to all the states that they would be considering amendments to 1.6 and also to 1.13, and that they would be doing that in light of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which is now we all refer to as the 307 Task Force. When we looked at their proposal, which the ABA did in fact approve 2 weeks ago, not without some controversy, but they did pass it, to both 113 and 106. We looked at their language that was proposed. Their language is very similar to what we now propose to this court, that you remove those overstrikes and put that portion of the rule back the way it has always been in South Dakota since 1987.
So the bottom line is we're right where we are today.
Yeah. Okay. And the only difference, Justice, is the ABA solution limits that remedial action that a lawyer can take to substantial financial harm. The ABA looked at it from the standpoint of the financial harm. When our board considered this, both the Ethics 2000 Committee and the Bar Commissioners, we said, we want to look at the fraud. Not the damage that the fraud caused, but the act of fraud that the client used the lawyer unknowingly. And if there's fraud, if the client used one of our members in a fraudulent scheme, that lawyer ought to have the right to take remedial action to correct that, and ought not to be restricted to only in those cases where there's substantial damage. They looked at money, we look at fraud, and we think that's the right side to be on. So this court now has our proposal that we reinstate the rule that we had, because we think it's better than what the ABA's fix is. We have not proposed anything on 113, because although the ABA has made a move to amend 113, they're doing it in anticipation of whether or not the SEC will accept that as substantial compliance with the Oxley Act. And we don't know that that's going to happen, and so we're leaving 113 alone at this point. What I can tell this court is that my understanding is that the SEC has delayed the implementation of its regulatory acts until they've had a chance to review what the ABA did. Once we have final action from the SEC, we will be back to this court, whether it be in February or next year or later, with what we figure out is the appropriate amendment to 113 to make that all work. And in the interim, I'm working to revise the cross-references and annotations to our rules because, as we know, some of our rules are different than the ABA, so that we can have printed in the new volume next year the appropriate comments. And what I will do, if we don't have a final fix by February, is I will cross-reference under 113 that they need, that any lawyer who is practicing in the SEC area that may be bound by the Oxley Act needs to be very familiar with the federal regulations which may supersede their conduct under 113.
You know, I think we've all read the substance of it, but it does bring up an interesting question of procedure. When would you want this to go into effect? Because the Red Books get published, what, June? Are you looking at a July 1, 2004 or sooner, or what do you think?
I think that the bar can live with either January 1 or July 1. Either one works. The our members obviously have the rules before them. They have it available in electronic form, either through us or through the court. And I don't know that there's a solid reason for deferring implementation past January 1. By way of precedent, and I'll do this by recollection because I have, frankly, Chief Justice, I hadn't anticipated the question. My recollection is that in 1987, when we did the full, we got rid of the old canons and so forth, and we adopted the model rules, that because every lawyer had received a copy of them, the court adopted a rule that put it into effect January 1, recognizing that it wouldn't come out in the Red Books until July 1. But my recollection is that we did that in 87, but that's a recollection, and I'm getting older, and so who knows how reliable. If the court wants to check that, you may decide that that is precedent or not. But I don't know that there's any significant reason for delaying implementation past January 1.
Okay.
The last comment I'll make is that I've already noted that the reciprocal licensing passed without a dissenting vote. I have been in consultation with Sherry Anderson. I defer to her expertise. This is an area that she knows. She has drafted an amendment and submitted to the court. She provided me with a copy of that. I circulated it to my Board of Bar Commissioners. Nobody had any objection to it. We understand that it does not, it carries out our intent, but fixes some of the other internal problems that they needed addressed. We deem that a very friendly amendment, and we support that amendment, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Barnett?
What's the latest update on the other states and their reciprocal licensure?
I can't give you the national view other than I can tell you that states, I think virtually almost all states over the last year and over the next several years are going to be taking this issue up. I know that Montana, their board has advised the Supreme Court that they want reciprocal licensing. Wyoming is headed that direction, at least studying the issue. It's not before the court yet. North Dakota has a form of reciprocal licensing. My understanding is that they're considering polishing that up somewhat to go, because the rule doesn't resemble anything like the example that most states are adopting. I don't know where Minnesota's at. Nebraska already has it. We've attracted some, I've got a lot of emails from around the country, and the comment I would give you is that many, many states are going to take it up. I don't ever see California doing it. I see a few other states that probably aren't. But the explanation I gave to our members at the annual meeting was, we're not opening the door to all these outsiders. We're simply agreeing to treat those people, their lawyers, in the same fashion that their jurisdiction will treat ours. And that resolved the controversy. And of course, almost everybody here is old enough to remember that when I got out of law school, we had reciprocal licensing. You could come in on motion. And many, many states did. Then we went through the battle. We got sued in 1980 by the Chicago lawyer that Andy Bogue, bless his heart. You can see the teardrops on the order where he filed against the state bar and the Supreme Court for the residency requirement. And of course, then the next thing the court did is just wiped out not only reciprocal licensing, the diploma privilege, and everything. So in one sense, it's a big circle. There's a symmetry here. We're coming back to where we all were back in the 70s when we got out.
Any further questions for Mr. Barnett? Being none, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Any further proponents of the revisions on the rules of professional responsibility? Being none, any opponents? There being none, that is the final proposal. The court will then close this public hearing and will take the proposals under advisement and render its decision at a later date. We'll be in recess at this time. We'll reconvene at 11 o'clock for our next scheduled oral argument. That will be in our courtroom in the Capitol building. We are in recess.